Hello and welcome to all of you. My name is Martha Humphrey, and I teach in the Department of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought here at Amherst. We're delighted to have you here today. It's one of the happiest weekends we have at Amherst College, and we hope you'll enjoy the fine weather, the good company, the pleasant times with family and friends, and the intellectual stimulation we hope to offer you today and tomorrow. Today we welcome back to Amherst Harvey J. Rosenfield, a member of the class of 1974, or should I say the great class of 1974, and one of California's best known and most powerful consumer advocates. After graduating magna cum laude from Amherst, Mr. Rosenfield went on to earn a law degree and a master's degree in foreign service from Georgetown University. He worked for Ralph Nader's Public Citizen Congress Watch from 1979 to 1981, and then was program director for the California Public Interest Research Group, or CalPERG, from 1982 to 1985. He wrote the landmark ballot initiative Proposition 103, passed by California voters in 1998, which required insurance companies to refund over $1.2 billion to California motorists, and has saved the state's consumers more than $62 billion through stringent regulation of insurance companies' rates and practices. His 1994 book, Silent Violence, Silent Death, exposes the epidemic of medical malpractice, and he has appeared in the 2005 documentary, Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room. He's also the current president of California's Consumer Education Foundation. But our guest is perhaps best known for his establishment in 1985 of the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights, now called Consumer Watchdog. With a particular focus on matters of insurance and healthcare reform, stronger privacy rights, energy industry accountability, and greater citizen participation in democracy, this nonpartisan, nonprofit organization is dedicated to fighting what it calls corporateering, the act of prioritizing commercial gain over individual, social, or cultural gain. Consumer Watchdog states on its website, "Big business has an endless amount of money and thousands of lobbyists working every day to protect and increase their profits, no matter who it hurts. We get in their way and work to protect and improve the lives of American consumers and taxpayers." Here to describe his longtime role in this effort is Harvey J. Rosenfield.
Thank you, Martha, and thank you all for coming out on a beautiful Saturday afternoon to my senior seminar on fighting injustice. This afternoon, I hope for the next few minutes to talk to you a little bit about, tell you some stories about 30 years of fighting Goliaths, from multinational, multi-billion dollar corporations to powerful politicians and even a very famous Hollywood actor. Our slingshot, since by definition David doesn't have many resources, our slingshot has included a truckload of horse manure, a man dressed in a chicken suit, and a red herring fish. You may be wondering why Amherst College would bestow upon me an honorary degree, and I've been wondering the same thing. Hopefully somebody will explain it to us. But my purpose here today is to give you a sense of what it takes to beat Goliath, why it's fun to be David, and hopefully illuminate some of the very contemporary issues of our time, from the Tea Parties to healthcare reform, and the question that seems to be on everybody's mind these days, which is, can government do anything right? So I want to start by talking about the ballot for insurance reform in California. One of the things that people have been trained to hate over the last few years as lawyers. This wasn't always so. It wasn't so in the 1970s when I first left Amherst and went to law school. But that has been part of a concerted strategy by big business that began really with the insurance industry back in the 1970s in California, when insurance rates started to go up for doctors. Their malpractice insurance premiums went through the roof. And the insurance industry was put under the gun, and its excuse was, well, we have to raise our premiums for doctors' malpractice insurance because there are too many lawsuits, too many malpractice victims and trial lawyers are bringing lawsuits against doctors. And that resulted in the passage of legislation to cap victims' rights to compensation, their day in court. That's known colloquially among all of us as tort reform. And it happened in the 1970s. It was signed by Jerry Brown, our governor at the time. And it's happened again repeatedly throughout the years. And in the 1980s, when I got involved, insurance rates were going through the roof, not just for physicians, but for motorists. The state had just, the legislature in California just passed a law saying people had to buy auto insurance. But California was the only major state in the nation, had no controls over how much insurance companies could charge or what practices they could apply in underwriting, whether they even sold insurance to you or not. So what I did was I set up an organization that is now known as Consumer Watchdog to press for reform. It didn't come as a big surprise to us that the legislature was owned lock, stock, and barrel by the insurance industry. So we did something that we can only do in a few states, and California is probably the leading exemplar of it. We have the initiative referendum and recall process, for better or worse, and I'm going to talk about how it's been for better, but it has been for worse sometimes. So we went to the ballot box, and the insurance industry's response when confronted with public complaints about higher insurance premiums in the 1980s was, look, it's the lawyer's fault. And in fact, in 1986, the industry had successfully sponsored a ballot initiative to roll back more legal rights of victims of environmental pollution and other torts. And so the sort of stage was set for a huge showdown between two different ways of looking at things. Our way, which was, the problem was in California that there was no regulation of insurance rates and practices, or the countervailing ideology from the insurance industry that was adopted pretty much wholesale by the business community and the medical profession, which was that it was the legal system that was responsible for higher insurance premiums. So what we did was I drafted Proposition 103 and put it on the 1988 ballot. It took about 800,000 signatures of registered voters to make sure it got on the ballot. And Prop 103 called for a 20% rate reduction and rollback of all auto, home, and business insurance premiums. It established an elected insurance commissioner to implement that. In the future, it called for, once the rollbacks had been paid by the insurance companies, stringent regulation of the insurance companies' rates and practices, and the restoration of the antitrust laws and the consumer protection laws, which the industry had managed to win exemptions from through the legislature in prior years. This was an unbelievable battle. The insurance companies mounted what remains an unprecedented initiative effort in California. They put three competing ballot measures on the ballot, which is a tactic designed to confuse the voters. So the voters, and sort of the idea being that the voters will just say, okay, it's not worth it. I can't tell which is which. I don't know what's best, so I'm going to vote them all down. I guess the industry understood that they could not defeat us directly once we got our message out there. But the question was, how do we get our message out there? We had no money for TV ads. We had about $400,000 in the bank, and the industry was spending about early on about $1 million a week on TV ads. So we had to rely on stunts. And the one that I'm probably still most famous for in the farmlands of California is when I drove a truckload full of horse manure down to Farmers Insurance. And our message was, the insurance industry's initiatives are full of bull. And that was on the side of the truck that I drove down there. So there's me, a much younger version of me, with my gloves. I had just finished trying to deliver a pail of horse manure to the CEO of Farmers Insurance, and now I was meeting with the press. And I have to say that of all the press conferences I've done over the years, that was the single biggest press conference that I've ever been part of, because I think that we learned an important lesson with the news media, how to approach the media and speak to them in the language that they think would be most interesting. And then one of the other things we did was we hired armed guards to guard the signatures that we collected to put Proposition 103 on the ballot. That is me on the left, and those are one of our armed guards on the right. But what you're looking at is a brochure that the insurance industry mailed to every single voter in California. Now, I don't think they really intended to do this, but eventually they turned this brochure into an ad in between the in which they attacked me. And between the ads and the brochures, I became, for a very short period of time, famous in California, and especially among gun-toting NRA types who wouldn't normally vote for an initiative to regulate an industry. So at the end of the day, at the end of the year, in November 8th, 1988, by the time Election Day rolled around, so many people had been inundated with industry information that and ads that they sort of intuitively began to understand that whoever is against Prop 103 is probably not on our side. And conversely, whatever Prop 103 is, it's probably going to be a good thing. And then obviously the word started to get out, editorial writers and so on, 20% rate reduction, that sounded pretty good. And on an election day, even though the insurance industry had spent $80 million, we won by about 1% of the vote. I want to say one thing about that. I got a lot of attention during that campaign, but the guy who really is responsible for the passage of Proposition 103 is Ralph Nader. Now, some of you in the audience are thinking about the Ralph Nader who has become the perennial candidate for president. But I want you to think back, for those of you who remember, to the Ralph Nader who was a pioneer in consumer rights and whose name was like the word of God when it came to issues of public policy. And that's the Ralph Nader who, he came to California quite a few times during 1988, campaigned for Proposition 103. And I believe that that's why, when you had $80 million and confusion across the spectrum and nobody really knew who to trust or what to believe, I think his presence was the reason why Prop 103 passed. Interestingly, for all of the things we've seen since in modern American politics, Prop 103 passed in liberal Democrat Los Angeles County and very conservative Orange County Reagan Republicans in Orange County across the board in those two counties. Why? Because that's where auto insurance rates were highest. I'm gonna come back to this, or I ask you to think about it as well. Here's a measure to impose the most stringent regulation of insurance rates in the United States, and it was supported by conservative Republicans in Orange County. There's a lesson there that I'll get to towards the end. Now, it turns out that was just the beginning of the battle for Prop 103. Over 100 lawsuits were filed in the next few years, and the final piece of the legislation that was approved by the voters in 1988, the piece that required insurance companies to base motorist premiums on their driving record rather than their zip code, that was not put into effect until 4 years ago in 2006, 18 years after the measure passed. But the perseverance paid off, both for the voters and in terms of consumer watchdog, because we hired lawyers, we worked day and night to make sure that the initiative was implemented correctly, defended it in the courts. As Professor Humphrey mentioned, the amount of rollbacks, $1.2 billion, about $62 billion in auto insurance rate increases blocked. And perhaps most important, bring it all the way back to the battle between the industry scapegoating the legal system and us blaming the industry and seeking stronger regulation. Eventually, Prop 103 applied to medical malpractice rates, and eventually we put a medical malpractice insurance company on the stand and challenged their rates. And under oath, their executives were forced to admit that the premiums that they charged doctors for medical malpractice had nothing to do with lawsuits. And that was my sort of aha moment, one of the great moments in the history of Prop 103. I wish I could tell you that the local California Medical Association had dropped its promotion of continuing restrictions on people's right to sue, but they have not. They continue to promote those restrictions, even though they have nothing to do with the price of insurance. And lest you think that now the battle's won and it's all over, in fact, no, it's never over. And that's one of the messages, that's one of the lessons I've learned. On the June 8th ballot, in this coming June, is a measure sponsored by one of the most recalcitrant insurance companies in California, Mercury Insurance. It's a local company. It does a little bit of business around the country. Mercury has, for all these years, for the last 24 years, fought insurance reform and Proposition 103 in the courts, in the legislature. It's put an initiative on the ballot to repeal a provision of Prop 103 that protects the poor against discrimination. And they've taken a page out of our playbook. If I've got this queued up right, I'm going to show you their ad. This is the ad that's on blanketing the airwaves of California right now.
There is only one place to get the facts about Prop 17, the official voter guide. A flaw in California law prohibits drivers from taking their continuous coverage discount with them if they switch insurance companies. Responsible drivers who maintain insurance shouldn't be penalized because they change insurance companies. Prop 17 fixes the law so drivers can take their continuous coverage discounts with them, just like their good driver discounts. That's why consumers, seniors, and small businesses say yes on Prop 17.
Sorry about that. Okay, so that's the 30-second ad that's carpet bombing the state. And as you can see, they took a page out of our playbook because what they're telling people is you can get a discount if you vote for Prop 17. We, on the other hand, have very little money, but we have managed to raise and scrape together about $900,000. And so here's the ad Let me see if I can. No, went too far. Technical snafus. Sorry, bear with me, please.
This is a consumer alert. Why are car insurance companies spending millions to pass Prop 17? The California Attorney General says Prop 17 will raise your rates. Stop the hidden rate increases. Vote no on 17.
So we have gotten every single editorial board in the state to come out against Prop 17, but they have, I think the latest number from the other night was $13.5 million in TV ads and mailings and so on. So whether we win or lose remains to be seen. But the I think there's one, the meta lesson from this battle for insurance, which started in the mid-'80s, or maybe even in the 70s and continues to this day, is you can really never rest on your laurels. You can really never assume that you have won a battle against a major industry like this. There's always another battle to be fought. So here's another battle that we fought, healthcare reform. Some of you will recall that in the early 1990s, the Clinton administration tried to pass healthcare reform and failed at the hands of a very powerful and persuasive industry campaign. The failure of the Clinton plan initiated the privatization of healthcare in our country, beginning in California, where nonprofit HMOs had been pioneered as a way to focus on preventative medicine rather than palliative medicine after the fact. And so the battle became one where the health insurance companies began a spurt of buying up nonprofits and hospitals, taking them over and turning it all into a for-profit operation. And then pretty soon, they started instituting practices like hiring bean counters to determine whether you're entitled to a particular form of health care that you needed. The theory, the strategy of the privatized health insurance industry was delay and deny care. And we saw that happening because, as I said, the HMOs were sort of pioneered in California, and when they were turned into for-profit entities, suddenly these practices emerged. So in 1996, we joined with the California Nurses Association, a union of registered nurses. I see somebody applauding back there, who was headed by a very powerful leader, just who had just taken over the organization, and we sponsored a ballot measure with the California Nurses Association to impose some restraints on the practices of the healthcare industry. And we were defeated. The industry spent about $6 million, but the real thing that defeated us was they were able to obtain a rival union's assistance. They hired a rival union to the California Nurses Association, put a countervailing initiative on the ballot. So then you had two ostensible groups of nurses fighting for reform, and the practice that they tried and failed to accomplish in 1988 worked in 1996, and our measure went down. But in that situation, the educational effort that went into trying to pass the initiative actually ended up providing the public support for legislation going through that would address the same issues that we were trying to tackle through the initiative process. So over the ensuing years after 1996, we were able to get most of what was in the proposition that failed passed by the legislature. But we ran into one big problem, a guy named Gray Davis. He became the governor of California, and he had scraped and clawed his way to that office over a period of 16 years. He was known for two things. He was a shameless self-promoter and an unbelievable fundraiser from the special interests. And what he became known for, in fact, one of his more creative promotions, he developed the idea of putting lost kids on milk cartons. And it was a very good tactic for him. It got him into the governor's office. But as soon as he took office, he started to resist the legislation we were proposing to allow HMOs to sue, sorry, allow patients who are injured by HMO practices to sue the HMOs. And what was happening was we couldn't actually get a meeting with the guy. He refused to show his face, even though he was meeting constantly with the people in the health insurance industry, lobbyists for the insurance companies. And after a while, we didn't know how to draw him out. Let's see if I can make this happen.
This is a consumer alert. Why a carton?
Here we go. So we developed our own milk carton. And we put Gray Davis on the milk carton, and we said basically he's missing, occupation, governor of California, last seen at a fundraiser with HMO executives. We distributed these milk cartons all over the state. We knew he was staying at a hotel in San Francisco, and we didn't know which room he was in, but we put him under the doors of every room in the hotel, and then he had a meeting with the San Francisco Chronicle an hour, like around 10 o'clock that morning, after we blanketed the hotel, and he completely had a meltdown, and he declared, when they said to him, you know, why are you spending so much time fundraising, why aren't you doing your legislative duties and making sure that legislation reaches your desk and so on, he declared that he didn't need the legislature, that he was the governor of California and there was no need for the legislature at all. And that, of course, went all over the state, and that foolish mistake on his part ultimately forced him to sign the HMO Patients' Rights Bill, because he did not know, he could not recover. That was the sort of the quid pro quo for everything that he had done wrong was to be righted by signing that legislation, which he did sign. And then another thing we did on healthcare reform, focused on the federal government, because you're probably all aware that President Bush signed a healthcare law, prescription drug law a few years back, which explicitly prevented the federal government from negotiating with drug companies to obtain lower drug prices for Medicare recipients. And we wanted to illustrate the fact that what many Americans were doing, because they couldn't get cheap drugs in the United States, they were going to Canada, flying to a border or across the border and going there and buying their drugs in Canada where they were a lot cheaper. So this is Jerry Flanagan from our office, standing in front of a train in Montreal, the train began in Miami, Florida. And we put senior citizens on the train all along the way, all the way up the coast. And of course, we would, every time the train stopped, we'd have a whistle stop press conference with senior citizens would come out and explain why they had to go across to get on a train, go across the border to Canada to get their prescription drugs. And it really, I can't say it changed the result of that, but it's highlighted the inequity of that prescription drug problem, which remains a problem today. Now, some of you are probably thinking, well, what's happening right now? How does this all fit together with what's happening in Washington, D.C.? Well, as you know, Congress passed a health insurance reform law a few months ago. Some of us believe that it would not have done so if it hadn't received the help of Blue Cross of California, which just when it seemed like the health care legislation was dead, sent many people, including myself, a letter saying that our health care premiums were going to go up by about 40%. My letter said that commencing in March, my premium would be $5,000 every 2 months. And every member of my family are very healthy, we have no diseases, $5,000 every 2 months. I mean, we're now approaching the cost of an Amherst education just for healthcare. So that seemed to resurrect the healthcare reform in Washington, D.C. But there's a big problem with that. Remember when I said that what instigated Prop 103 was the higher insurance premiums and there was no regulation of rates? There was a mandate that you buy auto insurance in California, but no regulation of the premiums. Well, we have the same thing now in this new health care bill. We fought very hard for two things. We fought for rate regulation and a public option as a competitor to private industry, and got neither of those. So there is an effort underway on our part to get the Congress to amend the new law to impose some form of powerful rate regulation. Because otherwise, think about what's going to happen. It's going to be like California in the 1980s. We're all going to be required by law to buy health insurance. Those of us who can't afford it, for some people, will be subsidized. But for the people who can afford it, there's going to be no control over how much they can charge you. The way that law was drafted is so it gives all the power to the insurance companies to decide what to charge. And our fear, of course, is that those rate increases will then lead to a massive voter revolt, like we saw in California, and which we took advantage of to pass Proposition 103. But who will vector that rage that will come out of homes across the United States when those rates start to go up? Well, we know who's been vectoring it for the last few months: the Tea Party and Republicans, who are exploiting the fear of rate increases. So that's something that this is an example where the Democrats in Washington, who, let's face it, are often just as beholden to special interests as the Republicans, have a problem that they're going to face. If they do not figure out a way to address this, the consequences will be grim, not just for their political prospects, but for all Americans. The next kind of battle that I want to talk about very briefly was electricity deregulation. And the reason why it's very relevant to what's happened today or in the economy in the United States. In 1996, the utility companies got together with Enron and a few other, and some power firms, newly created power firms, with the idea that we're going to promote deregulation all over the United States, and we're going to start in the nation's bellwether state, California. And when I say deregulation, I mean, instead of having regulated utility monopolies in the state, we're going to move to a system where the power is going to be supplied by for-profit private firms who would buy the power plants from the utilities, and there would be the Public Utilities Commission would no longer regulate the utility rates. Passed in 1996 unanimously, a lot of money was spread around by the industry. And lo and behold, what happens when it kicks in? Well, guess what? All of a sudden, we're in the middle of winter in Los Angeles. Nobody's using electricity, and the lights go off, and the cost of power in the so-called free market starts to soar, go through the roof. The utility companies can no longer afford even to buy it, and so they go up to Sacramento. The utility companies go up to Sacramento and say, something's gone wrong, we need a public bailout. Meanwhile, the private firms aren't being paid, they turn the lights off. They turned the lights off. Now, the Bush administration and the firms at the time were telling us that this was because California didn't build enough nuclear power plants. That was the reason why. But we were out there saying, I mean, it was obvious what was happening, right? We took the cop off the beat, and the robbers came in. They figured out a way to raise rates, and they did it. In fact, we found out a couple of years later, after the investigations began, that the utility companies and the Enrons and the Wall Street energy traders were doing things like sending energy out of state on the transmission lines and then buying it back, passing it through multiple purchasers and buying it back at a far higher rate to sell in California. So it was all part of a scam. And of course we learned that most of this was revealed when Enron sort of became a victim of its own scam and its accounting practices, and it collapsed. I would like to say that was a happy ending. Enron got what it's due, and you know, we moved on. But no, the state was left with a $70 billion debt for electricity. That was the total cost of deregulation to the taxpayers of California. It really killed California. When you hear about our budget problems, we can't staff our schools. We can't fix our roads. That there was a massive transfer of wealth from main streets in California to Wall Street as part of this energy deregulation thing, and the state ended up floating bonds to allow us to pay off those debts to the energy companies with interest over 20 years. Now, if all of that sounds familiar to you, you're probably saying, "Well, what happened? Why did we learn the lesson?" We didn't learn the lesson. As it turns out, that the what happened was, after the energy crisis and the collapse of Enron, there was the beginning of a nascent movement to reform and regulate corporations more carefully, especially some of the exotic tactics and financial instruments that they were using to move power contracts around and up the price of electricity. But then what happened was 9/11. And if you recall, for most of the subsequent years, we were told that our greatest enemy lived in a cave in Afghanistan. But in fact, I think Franklin Roosevelt had it right when he said this: "Our enemies of today are the forces of privilege and greed within our own borders." I think that's the real enemy, and the enemy that we didn't pay attention to was the pursuit of money by self-interested pursuit of money by powerful financial organizations, without any real connection to building anything in America, building an infrastructure, building a product. Much of what we saw in what's become casino capitalism was just the moving around of pieces of paper known as derivatives, which represent assets that themselves, nobody really understood where they were or who owned them, because all you knew is you had this piece of paper that was a derivative. And the result, if we had learned the lesson from Enron and the California energy crisis, we might have forestalled what happened a few years ago in our country. But we did not learn that lesson. Congress very closely allied with the finance industry over the preceding 10 years. And the result, of course, was this horrible financial collapse. And now we're in trillions of dollars of debt. And we can only hope that the fate of the nation does not follow the track that the fate of California has taken, which is a sad spectacle of the Golden State losing its tarnish. One more point, and I think I'm going to turn this over to a more of a question and answer format, and I want to offer some lessons. But I want to say one more thing about what happened with Gray Davis. He paid a pretty high price for his role in mishandling the energy crisis. He really didn't know what to do. And he was confronted with people like us who were saying you should seize those power plants, take them under control because they're manipulating the price of electricity. His advisors from Wall Street who were telling him, no, this is just the free market working and you don't want to interfere with that, and you got to play that out. And although he was reelected in 2002, His poll rating was so poor that some operatives from the Republican Party saw an opportunity to recall him, to use the recall process in California to take him out of office. And it became pretty quickly became a circus. You needed only 12% of registered voters needed to sign the petition to require the recall, and then anybody who wanted to run for the office could file papers and run for the, assuming he were ousted, run for that spot. Well, 135 candidates ran, including Larry Flynt, Gary Coleman, Arianna Huffington, and Cruz Bustamante, who was the lieutenant governor at the time. It was a circus, and that was exactly the opening that one of Hollywood's great cartoon characters was looking for. Arnold Schwarzenegger had meticulously planned a second career in politics. He married Maria Shriver, about as politically connected as he could be, and he'd sponsored an initiative of his own for after-school funding of gymnasiums. As the circus unfolded, Arnold swooped in, and he offered to play the leading role in a drama that everyone in California wanted to see, which was the cleanup of corruption in Sacramento. So here's some of his quotes. "I will go to Sacramento and I will clean house. I don't have to take money from anybody. I have plenty of money." So, you know, any of these kinds of big, powerful, special interests, if you take money from them, you owe them. So he said all the right things. We all, you know, the voters of California bought it. We went to the movies with him, and then he was elected. But the problem was, about a year later, he had actually outdone Gray Davis in fundraising. He spent all his time raising money. He had raised $125 million. At one point, he was like pulling in $72,000 a day from the biggest special interests in the state: finance, insurance, drug companies, real estate, car dealers. He had no program of his own because he was an actor. He hadn't thought about or really studied public policy. So he basically adopted the California Chamber of Commerce's agenda verbatim, and he just started going down the agenda of getting rid of consumer protections and getting rid of some of the health care reforms that we had enacted. So the question there for us was, well, what was the key to defeating Arnold? And the key was, of course, you have to unmask and undermine the celebrity, right? Because he was viewed as invulnerable, right? So what we did first, literally, was to talk about, we had to bring him down to size. That's Arnold Schwarzenegger on the beach, okay? That, just by itself, started to strip away the veneer of invincibility that this guy had. Because in Sacramento, the Democrats, they were like tourists. When Arnold took office, they were falling all over themselves to get pictures taken with him. They were not an opposition. He just had his way in Sacramento. So we began this process, which ultimately ended up in flying banners over the state capitol and over his home in Brentwood saying, you know, don't be a bully for big business. We tried to, we did the best we could to undermine his brand, because he was all about a brand. He was a cartoon hero. And as it turns out, these kinds of stunts helped strip away that cartoon hero veneer, and then he just turned out to be a politician like everybody else. Today, Arnold Schwarzenegger's poll rating is 71% negative. That's 1 point more negative than Gray Davis's was when he was ousted back in 2003. So I've tried to give you a little bit of a view of what it's like to wage a sort of David versus Goliath battle against some of the big special interests that have played a role in California. I want to answer one question I think people always ask me, so let me answer it in advance. How did I end up doing this stuff? So let me give you about a minute on myself. First of all, this is a letter I wrote to a Five and Dime when I was 9 years old, complaining that they stole me something and I wanted my money back. So I think I was kind of born with this. I ended up in Amherst from a public school in outside of Boston, Randolph, Massachusetts. I was a pretty much a regular kid. Let me see if I can pull that one up. Yeah, this is me as a freshman. I was a regular guy. In fact, I wasn't nearly as smart as most of the people at Amherst. And I embraced that, and I struggled to keep up with that, and I loved it. I was exuberant most of the time, not particularly exuberant here, but my... Well, it's too late for that now. I was exuberant most of the time, and then when I was ready to move on, I realized I wanted to be a lawyer, but I didn't even really know what that meant. I went to Georgetown. I got a joint degree in law and foreign service. I broke that up, and I traveled around the world midway through that 5-year program because I was ready. I'd been in school for a long time. I was ready to see the rest of the world, and something that I recommend to any young person who's, graduating Amherst, take a little time off at some point and check out the rest of the world, because there's some really amazing lessons to be learned. And I came back with a very acute appreciation of what our country was all about, for better or worse. Largely, whatever you have to say about the United States, and this was in the 70s, or even today, we have more opportunity in this democracy than by far in any other country. And I came back really jazzed to pursue law. And I ended my education at Georgetown, went to work for Nader through 1982, came out to California, worked for the California Public Interest Research Group as a program director. That's a campus-based public interest organization. There's one in Massachusetts and other states. And then in 1985, set up Consumer Watchdog. I'm going to end, I got this one way longer than I thought, I'm sorry everybody. Let me just end with, I want to reel out some principles that I have learned. And I want to humbly suggest that these might be good principles to help you lead a life of consequence, whether you're a graduate or beyond that. Number one, you have to love what you do. I love what I do. So I couldn't do this because the second thing is you have to work really hard in life to accomplish something important. If you sit back and don't pay your dues, you can't accomplish what you want to accomplish. You have to work really hard, and to work really hard, you have to love what you do. Number three, do not take no for an answer. The conventional wisdom is to be ignored. Don't be told, don't be limited by other people's views. When I first started writing Prop 103, I was told you could never beat the insurance industry. In fact, I was told that if I tried to beat the insurance industry, that the organization that I set up would be defunded, and I would make enemies, and I would never work at any job in California. And I didn't listen to them, and I urge you all not to listen to the conventional wisdom, do not take no for an answer. Speak up. Do not wait your turn, because if you hesitate to speak up, your voice will be lost. Time is too valuable, life is too short, and if you're ever in a place where people don't want you to speak up, you're in the wrong place. Move on. Do not compromise what you believe in. As I just mentioned, when I was doing Prop 103, I was told that the consequences would be grim if I proceeded. I was also told that if I stopped, I would be given a lot of money. I would never have to worry about raising money for a consumer watchdog again, and I turned that down. I just felt that I could not compromise what the voters needed, and I wasn't going to start then. I hadn't yet. Now, I used to walk around with this saying, quoting this Mexican revolutionary guy named Zapata, who said, "I'd rather die standing than live on my knees." But I don't want you to think that I've always lived on my knees. We've died a few times. I mean, we've lost a few things. We during the energy debacle, when we were able to prevent the legislature from bailing out the utility companies in Sacramento, but the consequence of that was they went into bankruptcy. And it's sort of a close call whether the people of California were benefited or hurt more by companies in bankruptcy versus bailed out utility companies. So, that said, you always have to risk that, but I still say don't compromise. Never be afraid to say you don't know and ask for help. I still consider myself a student, and I am always learning from my friends and colleagues. And I have found that people, number one, people like to be asked for help. Number two, you will gain enormous respect if you just say, I don't know, when you don't know. And along those lines, seek out mentors. I have had many. I wouldn't be standing in front of you if I didn't have a high school guidance counselor who helped me out and gave me some opportunities to work on some policy issues when I was in high school. And here at Amherst, I had a poli-sci professor who sort of took me under his wing. And then, of course, there was Ralph Nader, who was just instrumental in everything I'd done. And now I have the greatest satisfaction of all, which is I go out there bring on advocates, try to teach them what I know, and then I watch them develop skills that surpass my own. Embrace defeat. Now, this sounds weird because our society is geared towards victory. People don't like to talk about defeat, and most of us fear it. But in fact, what I have found is that every time there's a setback, that becomes an opportunity. When I was working at CalPERG, I applied to be the executive director of the organization, and there was some politics involved, and they told me no. So I walked away with my tail between my legs for a few weeks, and then I said, you know what, I'm going to found my own organization. I'm going to set up what became Consumer Watchdog. So I just read this thing in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago, that job prospects are difficult for the class of 2010. My argument to you would be to, for those of you who are in that class graduating tomorrow, embrace that challenge and go do something different than you thought you might be end up doing, and use that setback and that those difficulties as a challenge to overcome. I think I can tell you for certain, and I obviously don't know any of you graduates, I can tell you for certain that you will succeed and you will prosper from having the experience of overcoming that obstacle. And then two more lessons. Turn off your cell phones. And I'm only talking about this in a part metaphorically. You need to be able to hear what other people are saying, and you need to be able to listen to yourself. You are about to leave a place which really values reflection and contemplation. It's idyllic here. There's no other place like it. It's going to take a lot more effort for you to make the space to listen to what your heart is telling you, and you got to do that. So turn your cell phones off. Finally, maintain your capacity for indignation. I want to show you, this is a bill I got in 2003 from Nextel. It was my cell phone company. You see that charge right there for $2.50? That's a charge that they wanted to bill me to get a detailed bill. It's they billed me for the cost of billing me. That just infuriated me. So we sued them. We sued them. And it took us 7 years, but we just won people's money back. I got a check for $34.30, but so did about 24,000 other people in California. So maintain your capacity for indignation. And sometimes the smallest injustice is the worst, because whereas the big injustices, there are other people looking at them, the smallest ones nobody pays attention to. And I hate when the bad guys get away with that. So, okay, I treasured my Amherst education. I could not have achieved the modest successes for which the college is going to honor me tomorrow had I not been given this opportunity to attend this great institution. I learned how to learn here. Being recognized by the college is the greatest honor I have ever received. And my parting comment is, I am not going to rest on my laurels, the laurels that Amherst is going to bestow upon me tomorrow. I am going to heed the poet Dylan Thomas. He said, "Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light." Thank you. Yes, sir.
I have a question. Maybe we can take the national healthcare situation that you envision as an example. we will have a mandate to purchase health insurance, and therefore rates will go up. Somehow we missed out on the free market mechanism that if rates go up needlessly, somebody can undercut. Why not fight for that kind of opportunity instead of fighting for rates?
Yeah. In my particular field, which is insurance, I don't think there ever really is a free market. Whether you're a driver who's had accidents, or a person who's sick and who's had who has a pre-existing condition, as we call it, unlike the regular marketplace, if you're buying a widget, they will sell you as many widgets as you want to buy. It's not true of insurance. So I challenge the premise that there could be a free market. What we've seen in California, I think all over the country, is that the companies don't want to sell insurance, don't want to provide health care to certain people. And so I don't think the free market will operate correctly. Plus, the health insurance industry is very concentrated, right? You've got Anthem Blue Cross. It's the big, I believe that's now the biggest insurance company in the country. So I see little hope that the companies will behave themselves absent rigorous regulation. Yes, sir.
I was just wondering if you could comment on the auto insurance companies. The last few years seem to be indicting themselves that they're charging higher than it should. When you've got Company A saying we can save you $500 from B, C, and D, B is saying they can save you $500 from A, C, and D, et cetera. That means that they're all overcharging, right? Because they can all say, each one can save that much money. Seems like they're indicting themselves that they're charging.
Well, one indication that there's not a free market in car insurance is the fact that there are such huge variations in the prices that they charge. But what we found, for example, not now in California, because they're not allowed to do it, although they may be allowed to if their initiative passes in June, we found that if they don't like you for a specific reason, say, for example, they don't like the neighborhood you live in, or they don't like your occupation if you've been in the military, or as this one insurance company was mentioning, if you have a lot, they say their unwritten rule is that if it's hard to pronounce your last name, they won't sell you the coverage. Those kinds of things, the advertising is directed to everybody, but when it comes down to getting your policy approved, they figure out a way to deny your application. Yes, sir.
Every politician is always constantly running on a platform of beating down special interests and lobbyists. But it seems that there's never any really end in this, and there's never any reward for the consumer. You, as a consumer advocate, what would you suggest the public do to finally start a final reform against lobbyists and special interests?
We were just talking about that before this talk began. I don't think anything can be done short of an amendment to the First Amendment, because according to the United States Supreme Court, corporations have the same rights as people. That right extends to how much money they give in the political process. And as long as corporations have the unlimited right to give money, we have no First Amendment rights. And lobbyists have all the power. And so the only, if I were a member of the Senate, I would seek to impeach the justices who came before them and said that they were just calling balls and strikes. Because I believe that this latest Citizens United decision that says that corporations have the same rights as people will completely undermine and unravel our democracy. Short of that, if either the Supreme Court goes, or we've got to change the First Amendment to make it clear that it doesn't, that only people are entitled to those First Amendment protections. Yes?
I'm curious, in reference to your organization and the involvement, if any, in this TARP translated to Making Homes Affordable program, and the fact that only the last statistics I've heard is that out of something like maybe 3 million people in foreclosure, only about 1,700 had actually obtained permanent modifications under.
Yes.
Is your organization involved in that in any way in terms of addressing those issues?
Not directly. One of the other organizations I work for has a website called whereisourmoney.org, in which we talk about those issues and comment on them. So far, the total bailout to the financial industry, including not just direct cash grants, but also access to funds at very low interest rates, is about $10 trillion. With that amount of money, if that amount of money had been given to the American people rather than to the banks, we could have paid off almost all of our debts, our mortgages, our credit cards. We could have started afresh. Instead, it all went to those firms. So there's a systemic problem in Washington, D.C. based on the imbalance of power power between consumers and lobbyists. And that's why there's just been such a poor record of protecting people's right to stay in their homes, or hope to stay in their homes. Yes?
Hi. So we've gotten health care reform passed. And, you know, there's another piece of the physician's interest. We're interested in the SGR, which is a calculated formula that deals with Medicare reimbursement for physicians. Is your organization at all advocating for any kind of addressing the SGR?
We don't really do much on that, no. No. We just tend to focus mostly on the most important issues for consumers as we see it. Although I'm not suggesting that there's not an immediate impact, but the way we choose what we work on is we look for things that other people either can't do or won't do, and we work on those issues. Things that other groups are afraid to say or don't feel have the wherewithal to take on, that's kind of what we do. I want to acknowledge somebody in the audience that you should all know. He's a trustee here at Amherst. Christopher Lehane is he's an amazing guy. He's actually advising us, giving us some help on this fight against the insurance industry initiative on the June ballot. And I think he could probably tell you even more fascinating stories than I've tried to tell you today. So if you stick around, get to say hello to Chris. He's an amazing guy. Class of 90.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Specifically target women with cervical breast cancer to revoke their insurance.